Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Good evening, and thank you very much for joining us. Our guests tonight are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and by telephone, Dermot Cole, columnist of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Paul, the death of a legend, Wally Hickel dies at 90. I know it's a tough chore to summarize his career, but tell us the summary and a summary also of his relationship with the oil industry, which is interesting and surprising.
It would take about a 300 or 400 page book to summarize Wally Hickel. The word I've heard most, I think, over the past week or so has been visionary. Here was a guy shows up in Alaska with 37 cents, give or take, depending on the story. And then the next thing you know is he's building hotels and he's a multimillionaire. He had a different view of Alaska. He saw Alaska as an owner state. He was driven kind of by the guy he called the little man who he would talk to. I'm assuming it's conscience or an inner voice. I saw him as the Yogi Berra of Alaska politician. You can't let Mother Nature run wild. And I think one of my favorite ones was frontiersmen are optimists, pessimists never get out of town. It's just that's how he had, and there's a whole book out there, I guess, of his.
You
of
can't
his,
save yourself his, rich is another one.
Wallyisms, yeah. He was governor. He was a twice governor. He ran for governor and lost three times. He was Nixon's Department of the Interior Secretary for a brief period until he contested the Vietnam War or wondered why the administration wasn't paying attention to war protesters, and they sent him on his way. He was an environmentalist of sorts while he was in the Department of Interior, adding endangered whales to the endangered list, and the Santa Barbara oil spill is what he's particularly known for. And he was opposed going into that job by environmentalists who thought that he was much too developmental for them. His relationship with the oil industry is complex, I think is probably the best way to put it. He was not pro-oil industry. In my mind, he's pro-Alaska. And he was very combative with the oil industries when it came to Alaska. Alaska first, you're going to take care of Alaska or get out, drill here, do this, do that. And essentially, he was Alaska's representative in the battle against what he saw as people who were encroaching on Alaska's rights.
And at the same time, people like Robert O. Anderson, the famous oil man, he'd tell you that he's my best friend
or
one of my best friends.
They had he was one of these people who could disagree, I think, without being disagreeable. And he got to the point where he managed during his term to wring from the oil industry, if you will, billions of dollars in oil tax settlements that were just hanging out there for years. It's just the start of the Constitutional Budget Reserve. So all in all, his legacy here will take not one book, but probably three, to even begin to summarize what he did and what he tried to do. And I think what he tried to do sometimes was more impressive than what he actually did. So
thank you for that generous assessment. Steve, how you covered him for three decades.
Right, yeah.
How would you describe his relationship with the media?
Paul used a good word, complex. I think that was a good word to describe Wally Hickel. I think his relationship with the media, like most politicians who are out there and bigger than life, you know, he had his moments that he would talk to you and sit down with you one on one and go in depth with what he wanted to do and what he believed in and his philosophy. And then there were times where he just didn't want any part of you, you know. And I think. If you wanted to talk to him, particularly when he got out of the governor's office the second time around in the 90s, it was pretty much definitely on his terms. I mean, you would never just see him in the lobby of, say, the Captain Cook Hotel and say, "Hey, Governor, could you come over here and talk to us? We've got a camera set up." It would never happen that way. It would take time. It would take briefing, maybe. It would be his aides would say, "What are you going to talk to him about? We have to brief him," that kind of thing. It was kind of almost orchestrated in a lot of ways. I will go back, though. It was very, very difficult to talk to him during his second term as governor. It was very,
1990
very hard.
To 94.
Right. Coming out of let's see, Steve Cooper at that time, right? And I can remember always David Ramser was Steve Cooper's media guy. David went on later on, became, I think it was a chief aide for Mark Begich when he was in the mayor's office. He was also a chief aide for Tony Knowles. But David Ramser was also a media guy for Steve Cooper. And it was very laid back. You could call David and say, hey, can we get the boss to talk about such and such issue today? David would say, let me walk down and go see if he's okay. So he'd go down, and sure enough, they'd get a camera in front of him. They'd ask the questions we wanted to ask, and they'd stick on Cooper's interview on the governor's feed, and that's kind of how we had to do business back then. With Hickel, it was very, very different. I mean, most of the requests we had for sound bites or interviews were just ignored. So during the second term of the governor, the relationship with the media, rocky, very rocky. But I think as he became the elder statesman, he wanted to talk to people about what his stances were on issues that were near and dear and to his heart, and you could sit down with him for long periods of time and have good conversations.
One of the things I got a kick out of with him is if he didn't like what you'd written or said or the television videos, he'd just come right out and tell you. And mm-hmm. Several times he would be brutally frank with me and then just say, but that's okay, Mike, you're all right anyway, wham. And then we go back to sort of business as usual.
There was one touching time, one moment that really touched me in an interview that I did with him. It was his 80th birthday, and he talked about Richard Nixon calling him up and saying, I need you to be our Interior Secretary. And Nixon kind of gave him the spiel as to why he should come.
Pep talk.
And then hung up the phone. And Wally Hickel hung up the phone at his end, and he said, I started crying. And I asked him, you started to cry? And I said, why did you cry? And he just said, this is the only place I ever wanted to be was Alaska. I was totally dedicated to helping Alaska. And now all of a sudden, the president calls up and says, I need you in Washington, D.C. How do you say no to the president? But I always was touched by his honesty in that. It was a very touching detail.
That's interesting, too, that he never seemed to really want to run for Senate or Congress. Right. First of all, he never did. He wanted to be governor. And part, of course, being a senator is one of being 100, but it's also going to Washington, D.C., and you live there permanently. Mm-hmm. When Wally Hickel went there in 1968, he knew he was not there.
Yeah. Last comment, if I may,
yes,
Michael.
Yes, of course.
Because he really was one of my favorite people. You couldn't put him in a box. And again, Paul says complex, and totally complex. This is the guy who, if environmentalists thought him sitting at the controls of a bulldozer, ready to just like flatten anything in his way. This is a guy who's credited with helping to save whales, helping to save the American alligator. I mean, he declared war on alligator poaching in the Everglades. We've got old film of him going out in a fish and wildlife boat in dark, deep night out on the Everglades to go out and just see what these guys are doing. He did a lot of good things for the country.
Dermot Cole, let's get you in here. Sorry to keep you waiting. I was hoping you could tell us the first time you met Wally Hickel and what you remember about it, and also tell us something about Wally Hickel's relationship with Fairbanks.
Well, thanks, Mike. First of all, going back to something Steve had said, during Wally's second term as governor, one of the things that sticks out in my mind is that the people around him were really insistent that he not be referred to as Wally. They wanted him referred to as Walter J. Hickel. And I think
memos on this subject.
Yeah, and I think we sort of caved in and, began calling him Walter J. I think everybody but Dugan might have called him, Walter J. But anyway, in person, obviously, he was Wally to most people. I remember clearly the first time I ever met him. It was in 1978 when he announced his campaign for governor that year. And I was just struck by this speech he gave. It was so at odds with Jay Hammond, who was would speak in great cautious terms about the future, whereas Hickel came out and he was talking about the Rampart Dam and how that we should have built that and we should have
Road
build the
to
railroad
Nome, perhaps.
To the North Slope and he was just he's always sort of the nonstop progress mentality, I guess, really. He just, and in those days, he was very sharply critical, you remember, of Jay Hammond
Well, Dermot, if I might, I mean, one of the things that strikes me about Governor Hickel is that he absolutely believed in action. He was the guy who said, don't just sit there, do something.
That's right. And that was his big criticism of Jay Hammond, right? He said, and in fact, I looked up a quote from this story that I wrote at that time, and he said, he was enough of this gloom and doom is a bunch of crap. And he was basically, you know, this is a happy, young, vibrant country, and don't put a cloud on and say, don't walk here, don't walk there, don't step on the dandelions. You know.
Hey, I have one more Fairbanks question that just occurred to me. Some people might wonder about his relationship with Joe Vogler since he ran on the Alaskan Independence Party line in 1990. Do you know how well they knew each other, if really at all?
No, well, I think they knew each other the way, you know, most people in Alaska do when they're involved in politics, which is that they were acquaintances. They certainly weren't good friends. I believe it was Edgar Paul Boyko who helped kind of put that deal together, and that was a strange incident in itself, you know. But I guess, Mike, the thing I really want to mention about Fairbanks, Hickel first made his mark here tremendous story, really, of how the Travelers Inn Hotel was built in Fairbanks. As you'll remember, people in Fairbanks were fighting in the 1950s. About where to build a new hotel, a modern hotel. There were no modern hotels here at the time. And anyway, there was one group wanted it at point A and one group wanted it at point B, and they could never agree. In the end, Hickel came in, and in order to build it, he had to raise about $200,000 in Fairbanks to help with the financing. And he did. And they had, and in 5 years, the bondholders were all paid off in 1960. And the Travelers Inn was built largely because his initiative.
Thank you very much, Dermot, and thank you very much, guests. Once again, I'm here with Paul Jenkins, Steve McDonald, and Dermot Cole from Fairbanks. Steve, the Gulf of Mexico blowout remains in the news. At this point, does Alaska have any wisdom to offer those engaged in attempting to cap the blowout and clean it up?
I'm sure it does. We certainly went through something similar to this anyways in terms of oil, massive quantities of oil being in an ecosystem. So there are stories and people who are down in the Gulf right now, in the Gulf region, sharing stories of what happened after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, sharing expertise with how to deal with oiled animals and birds, things like that. And there are certainly people who are in professional positions too. For instance, Ali Eska, who have gone down to lend their expertise down there in the Gulf. So, and I think there's probably an awful lot more that Alaskans can lend to this effort. This is a marathon. This is not a sprint.
Yes, that's
right. I think at some point in time, they meaning maybe the federal government or BP or folks in the Gulf region, will tap Alaskans and their knowledge about dealing with catastrophic events like this, and I think that'll come. You know, we're starting to see a little bit of it now.
Okay, thank you very much, Dermot. What does this mean for the Shell program of drilling in the Alaska coastal waters this summer and in the future?
Well, Mike, it certainly has put a cloud at least on this summer's plan. Well, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on Thursday, you know, rejected an attempt to stop the Shell plans. But still, the federal government is asking Shell for more information, and it's not clear yet whether or not the federal government is going to give it the final go-ahead to drill wells this summer off the coast.
And you can imagine what the reaction would be if something actually went wrong.
I'm kind of expecting they will not get this approval. I mean, I guess it's possible, but I think the federal government is going to look for a reason to say no.
And the Shell people will say, no, this is entirely different. We're well prepared for this. We have all this redundancy and preparation and so forth.
And the biggest difference, well, there's two big differences. Ice is one difference, and that kind of that's a kind of a problem. But the water there is so much shallower than the Gulf of Mexico. It's only, you know, you're talking about hundreds of feet as opposed to a mile deep. So there is that's the thing that the oil industry stresses. But I guess I'd be surprised if the federal government gives its blessing at this moment.
Okay, Paul, sorry to keep you out of the loop here for so long. Congress is holding hearings. What have they heard, and what have we, the public, learned?
I think we're still in the learning process. So we've learned most recently that the spill may be as much as 10 times larger than they thought it was. Calculations were suspect. We've learned that it was a blowout preventer, apparently failed to function correctly, and a methane explosion. And we've learned that we're not as prepared as we'd hoped to be to deal with something like this. And it's amazing to me the federal government is now being accused, as the state government was here during the Exxon Valdez oil spill, of not enforcing its own rules, not demanding that the equipment be in the right place, that the regulations be followed. There are questions now in the Gulf of whether permits were given without inspection, whether inspections were adequate.
They can't find the data the
couple hours before the explosion. It's all very embarrassing for, I guess, everybody involved. But worse, it's bad news for the Gulf Coast of the United States.
Paul, let's stick with you. Meade Treadwell is running for lieutenant governor. This is a major announcement this week in the political field. Who is Meade Treadwell and why is he running as a Republican?
I think that's his problem right there. Not those two questions, who is he and why is he running? He's quite a guy. He's chairman of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. He's been that way since 2001, appointed by Bush. He's a senior fellow at the Institute of the North. He's a very close friend of Wally Hickel's. Wally Hickel's very much involved in this stuff. He was deputy commissioner for DEC under Hickel, and he's the CEO of a technology investment company called Venture Ad Astra. He's a very knowledgeable guy about the Arctic. He knows a lot about Alaska. His problem, I think, is name recognition. While I think in his circle, I think he's very well known to the media. He's very well known to government, but I don't know that the average guy going out on his snow machine on Saturday, if you ask him, who's Meade Treadwell, I don't think he knows. He's got to catch up. I think he can do that, but he's got a long way to go.
Paul, that probably means spending a bunch of money in a short period of time.
Money is always the answer, despite what they say.
Okay, let's stick with that. Steve, can he catch Jay Ramirez, who is, and we shouldn't mention that Eddie Burke is in there, but
right.
At the moment, I think it's fair to say that Ramirez is the favorite.
He's a front runner. He's been doing it longer than anybody in this particular race. He's also got a lot of name recognition because he's a member of the legislature, high-profile member of the legislature. Plus, he has that big old hotel up there in Fairbanks, which is a successful venture. He has some pretty good chocolate chip cookies, too, at the bill desk there, I have to admit. I've had a few of those. So he's on those ads. He's on those ads. So you see him in different facets of his life. As Paul mentioned, Meade Treadwell is pretty impressive guy in his own right. He made a comment to the media that he knows he's got to catch up. He may have to spend some of his personal wealth. I'm not that familiar with his personal wealth. I don't know what kind of money he has, what kind of bank account he has right now, but he made it sound like he was going to have to throw some of his own money in here. And I think if he, you know, he can, I mean, it's always possible, he can catch up, but he's going to have to really work hard to get his name out there and let people know exactly who he is.
And a couple of things. One is this does not look like it's going to be a high turnout election because of just the dynamics of this election.
And people are going to be spending money on the governor's race, not a lot of money probably thrown towards the light govs race.
Okay, thank you very much. Dermot Cole, let's get you back in here. What's the Fairbanks report as we approach summer? What are the issues that are concerning your community?
Well, Mike, first off, if you are allergic to birch pollen, this is kind of a bad week. The birch pollen levels in Fairbanks are at record levels. The other day I wrote that they had not ever exceeded the 3,000 mark on the way they calculate it. And as of Thursday, it was nearly 4,000. So a normal year, it's about 1,000. So this is there's a lot of people sneezing and, you know, suffering from this allergy. And I guess this has caused the high levels are linked to the dry weather we've been having, and it's been a little bit windy, and that's helped spread the pollen all around. And if you live out of town, and if you park a vehicle near the trees, it's covered in yellow because of the pollen collecting on it. Another thing, this is a UAF graduation weekend, and there's a record number of doctorates to be awarded this weekend, about 40, I think, and that's probably the highlight of the commencement exercises, which is Sunday afternoon at the Carlson Center. And Tom Albanese, who's the UAF alumni, who is the head of Rio Tinto, one of the world's major mining companies, is going to be the commencement speaker.
And I noticed in one of the stories you had that there's a remarkable difference in the rate or the percentage of the graduates who are female versus male.
Yeah, actually, I don't know if people have been paying attention to this, but over the years, this has become a real strong trend that women are pursuing college education in Alaska far to a much higher degree than men. And at UAF, it's like a 60-40 split. And this weekend, there are about 700 women and 470-some men who are getting degrees, and that's, you know, it's an interesting phenomena that probably doesn't bode well for the men of the future.
Although perhaps some of them assume that they don't need college to make the kind of income that they hope to make. Perhaps that's part of what's this.
I'm sure it's complicated. It may be that, you know, people are thinking that construction jobs are, you know, that sort of thing are more attractive. But, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to play out in the future. I mean, it seemed like the trend would be to people with higher education will be more in demand for those positions. You know?
Okay, let's get back to Steve McDonald here. Steve, the Anchorage Assembly calls an end to the emissions testing program. This came quickly and essentially painlessly.
Yeah, I think it was the unanimous vote. I think it was 11-0. I'm assuming that all the assembly members were there. But it was the unanimous to kill the program. Program's still going to be around for a while, though. The assembly built in at least a six-month advance notice to the places that do IM testing for emissions, so they can kind of brace for that loss of business. Also, there has to be notices filed with the state, and the federal government has to review this. So it's going to be like April of 2011 before the program officially meets its doom. But this is something that has been talked about here for a few years now. At one point, this issue was before the assembly, and the idea of killing the program was defeated. There were thoughts at the time that while CO emissions were down, benzene was being kicked up into the air by cars, and folks on the assembly at that time said, you know, well, we need to keep the IM program in place to lower the amounts of benzene. They've gotten some assurances now that benzene levels are on the wane and will be so in the future because of the way cars are being constructed these days. So the program is kind of on its way out right now.
The word we're looking for, I think, here is kaput.
Kaput. Yeah.
Okay, Paul, we hear a lot of complaints, especially about dust. And a lot of the dust is there because it's from the winter when we were trying to sprinkle our streets so they'd be safe. What can we do?
Well, we can stop sprinkling our streets with dust and rocks, I suppose.
Large cans of pledge.
But I think even at that, this is glacier country. There's silt everywhere. You need to be out by the Matanuska River when the wind is blowing, and I think you get an idea, out in the valley anyway, of where a lot of that dust comes from.
Near your home.
Well, it's just, I mean, it's this incredible cloud of the stuff. I'm not sure as much we can do. I think we just live in a dusty environment, and that's just the way it's going to be.
Okay. I'm going to stick with you, Paul. The Port of Anchorage, we now learn, is running years behind its expansion schedule and budget. What happened?
Well, odd you should ask. The port, I guess to try to explain this, the port is building, they're getting away from a dock that's been there since before the earthquake. They're building horseshoe, rather revetment kind of things, fronting that with stainless steel. And they're driving that down into the muck. They're filling behind it from shore, and they're going to be out quite a ways out into the inlet. Some of the stainless steel sheeting, when it went down, was being pounded into the ground, apparently buckled, moved, spread apart. That all has to be repaired. But at the underlying cause of all this, they say, all these problems, they've lost 1,800 man hours of pile driving since they started the project because of protection for beluga whales. They can't pound 2 hours ahead or 2 hours behind tides. They have all kinds of other restrictions. So basically, protecting they're short on finances. They still need another $275 million. It's over budget, it's over cost, it's over time. It's I think they're estimating it'll take 2 more years. But the shipping companies, oddly enough, are looking at like 2020.
Yeah.
They think, well, no, it'll be a little longer than that. One of them's even selling off cranes that they bought for the because there's not going to be a dock to put them on. It's a mess.
Steve, we have about 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. Should somebody be held accountable for this, or how do we deal with this?
Well, I'm not sure. I think everybody's trying to figure this out now. The Assembly has kind of appointed a committee. Not kind of. They've done that. They've appointed a committee to go out and study this and find out just where things went awry. And it sounds like they planned this huge, big project and really didn't put the financing in order. They were hoping to get some stimulus money from the federal government. That didn't come through. So now what?
The election results changed, and Ted Stevens stopped being a United States senator. That was another thing.
Yeah, that's true, too. And it's those whales, those pesky whales.
Okay. We're about out of time. Thank you very much for joining us here on Anchorage Edition. We'll see you here next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.